solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You are not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
Nothing in chess is easy to break down. So, again, one of the things I feel that chess has taught me is that very far from controlling your brain is a wild horse there. And you need to work with it. You need to work with it. Sometimes it'll betray you. And it's operating according to its own clock, its own schedule. You can't impose control on that. And so creativity partly is learning how to understand that you will lose control. So I've often alluded to this thing of losing control. Losing control can happen at many levels. Psychological, you can feel uncomfortable with playing something, and so on. And so in chess, it's not enough to focus on the skills you can learn. There are also the skills you must become intelligent.
Welcome to the 21st conversation of the Play to Potential podcast series. This is a series of reflective conversations with leaders across diverse fields such as business, sport, and the arts. In this series, I like to talk to people about their journeys and try and get to the bottom of why they did what they did at various inflection points and how they grew to the top of their profession. I'm Deepak Jayaraman, the host and the curator of this podcast series. I'm an executive coach and work with senior executives and help them with two questions as they go through their leadership journey: where to go and how to grow. Where to go is often about helping them pick the right canvas and context for them to flourish when they are at a pivotal transition point. And how to grow is often about helping them scale their leadership capabilities in a certain organizational context. You could visit transitioninsight.com for more details. I'm excited to share this conversation with an individual who's been a personal role model of mine for several years, right from my days of schooling in Chennai. The guest is no other than Vishwanathan Anand, one of the greatest chess players of all time. Apart from his accomplishments as a chess player at the highest levels, I've always been a big fan of his simplicity and his humility. In fact, when I was preparing for my conversation with Vishy and reached out to a few leaders to ask them what they would like to learn from Vishy, the first thing most of them said was, ask him how he stays so grounded despite the towering heights he has reached in his field, and how he stays so level-headed through the ups and downs. It was an absolute privilege and a humbling experience to spend time with him. We spoke about a range of topics, ranging across how he picked chess as a career, role of EQ in becoming a chess champion, how his approach to self-development shifted after he became a grandmaster, his take on the role of humans in a world where the machines are getting exponentially more powerful, how he's dealt with failures, his approach to harnessing the power of the human brain, how he copes with digital distraction and ensures mindfulness in whatever he does, and much, much more. I personally learned a lot from the conversation, and I sincerely hope that you will find it purposeful too. You could access this conversation or specific segments of this conversation at playtopotential.com or on iTunes, Stitcher, or one of the other podcast apps. Just a quick additional comment on the format of the podcast. If you're looking for a quick insight here or there, or clean listicles of 7 things to become a better person or 13 things to stop doing from tomorrow, I have a feeling that this podcast series may not be up your alley. I feel that life is a little too nuanced for such clean, definitive, and prescriptive lists. But if you're open to immersing yourself in someone else's journey and understand how they thought about various inflection points and the mindset with which they've gone about the journey, I have a feeling that you might walk away with an insight or two that could help you. Without further ado, over to my conversation with Vishy.
Vishy, thank you so much for your time. Excited to be talking to you. Same here, thank you. I want to start with one of the advertisements of yours that I saw a few years back, where you're on the cricket field, you're facing a fast bowler, and you face 3 or 4 balls and you get beaten 2 times and you get bowled a couple of times. And the punchline for that ad was, pick your sport carefully, right? And I think it was in the context of a computer company.
That's right.
But I think it left a mark in my head, and the reason I want to start there is I'm curious about how people pick their career or pick their sport. So I would love for you to talk a little bit about how you got into chess, and specifically the inflection point where you made a commitment to chess as a profession, and what were the trade-offs at that time?
Okay, yes, it was a nice ad. It was for AMD, actually.
Uh-huh.
And the idea was, you may not even have considered us. You probably just heard of Intel.
Right.
But it's worth finding out what's right for you and not... And they tried to make that point with cricket and chess.
Got it.
That you might just think you have a... That you like playing cricket or something like that. But in fact, your true calling might lie somewhere else. So it's worth thinking about that choice.
Right.
I actually found chess quite quickly in life. I was 6 years old and my mother taught me how to play. So I was lucky because typically you learn chess from someone. And in my case, someone at home, my mother played it. So it was...
Was she a competitive chess player as well?
No, she was not. She was a good chess player in the sense that she used to play quite a lot with her at home, with her father and brothers. And she knew enough to teach me... But in chess, as in everything else, you get better by practicing, and she had never any time to go to a chess club and play chess. And,
sure.
So especially once she got married and she had kids, she never had time to pursue on chess. But having said that, for a long time, we could discuss what I had done and things like that. So it was nice. And you know, she was able to follow a little bit of what I did. I didn't think about this question in a logical way. I mean, when you think about choices like this, you think of a pen and paper and listing options and writing the pros on one side and writing the cons on the other side. And if you don't do it literally in the way I've described, then you at least are thinking of someone who's got a mental process of what's the argument for, what's the argument against. I can't recall having that thought about chess. I was quite lucky in life that at a lot of the crucial, if you like, inflection points where you would hesitate, I was buoyed by big successes at the chessboard. So when I finished my 12th standard, or rather when I finished my 10th standard, I became national champion.
Wow.
That's nice. I mean, it points you at least that... or to suggest to you that you have some future in this career and things like that. And it makes this easier to take this decision. I would say with someone who gets into sports as a career, usually or should be motivated by love. In which case, it's very difficult to have a very rational talk even with yourself.
Right.
I mean, it tends to be heart versus head. In the maybe a couple of decades before me, this conversation tended to be between your parents being the head and you being the heart. And you've heard a lot of cases of people saying, you know, this was my passion, but they wanted me doctor, engineer. That was the usual refrain in those days.
Sure.
So I was very lucky. After the 10th standard, I became national champion. After the 12th standard, very soon afterwards, I became world junior champion and grandmaster. And I think those more or less clinched it.
Got it.
In the sense that once I became a grandmaster, I knew, I mean, a grandmaster is quite a nice title to have. You get invitations to good tournaments, which means you tend to get good financial conditions, and I knew that already the risk I was running was very low.
Got it.
And I was very lucky that at critical moments this happened. Now, I went to college and I did my BCom there. I did my BCom as a sort of stopgap. I thought it'll give me options in the unlikely event, but already it was clear to me that I was going to be a chess player.
There was enough evidence on the other side, yeah.
Yeah. But I just felt, well, let me do my BCom in case I want to switch or something, in case I feel like I have to change, and it gives me options. But when I finished my university, I was already in the top 10.
Wow.
And so my decision was made for me. So I always say that I got into chess, and it's not that you choose chess. You eventually have a very strong reason not to choose chess, and I never found that reason.
Mm. Very interesting.
Just a quick pause here. Vishy talking about doing a BCom as a plan B despite his meteoric rise in the chess world is an interesting thing to note. In one of my earlier conversations, I was talking to Amish Tripathi, who's an alumnus of IIM Kolkata and was pursuing a career in financial services. He spoke about how he thought about the transition to writing.
It was a pragmatic decision. Look, I come from a middle-class family, okay? So I always joke that मेरे पास बाप दादा का आशीर्वाद है जायदाद कुछ नहीं है तो आई हैव टू बी प्रैग्मैटिक एंड प्रैक्टिकल इन माय करियर डिसीजंस आई हैव रिस्पांसिबिलिटीज यू नो आई एम ब्लेस्ड विद अ चाइल्ड आई हैव अ वाइफ सो आई रिजाइंड ओनली आफ्टर माय सेकंड बुक व्हेन माय रॉयल्टी चेक बिकेम ग्रेटर देन माय सैलरी चेक
व्हाइल दीस थिंग्स ऑफन बॉइल डाउन टू रिस्क प्रेफरेंसेस इट्स पॉसिबली वर्थ नोटिंग दैट इट्स ऑलमोस्ट एज इंपॉर्टेंट टू एंश्योर दैट यू हैव अ सेफ्टी नेट अलोंग द वे before you take a plunge in a certain direction. If taking a plunge into a low-odds field is of interest to you, you might also value the insights from the journey of Papa CJ, where he talks about his journey from being a management consultant after an MBA from Oxford to becoming a stand-up comedian. You could find these segments at playtopotential.com. Now, back to the conversation with Vishy Anand.
And I think you touched upon it briefly, Vishy, which is the commercial payoffs, right? Again, when one thinks about career, one is sort of the low odds sometimes associated with some careers, whether it's art or, you know, singing or sport. The other is the commercial elements around that path. In your case, I guess there was enough evidence on the other side, so there was no real trade-off maybe. But when somebody approaches you today about, let's say, a career in sport or a career in chess, what's the typical advice you provide on how they should think about it as against traditional paths that you suggested?
Well, the world is changing so much that I don't have an easy answer. I basically tell them not to foreclose their options too early. So especially if you're a 7-year-old, an 8-year-old and you think you really love chess, well, you should still be loving it in 4 years.
Hmm.
So don't foreclose options because... First of all, I believe that going through the educational process is very healthy for you as a person as well.
Right.
I mean, you can be a socially challenged nerd, which is not ideal in our times.
Mm.
So it's worth going to school, having classmates, you know, learning a little bit about, let's call it emotional skills.
Sure.
I always advise don't foreclose your options too early.
Right.
Because nowadays, I'm not even sure that your engineer doctor stream is that safe. What is safe in these days, in today's context?
Mm.
What counts as a safe job? Which job are you sure that you will never be fired and you'll have a stable salary all your life? The world is also changing. So even from the time when I made my decision, it's very hard to extrapolate wildly from that.
True.
I mean, these are heavily cliched answers. You know, you have to stay in the learning process. You have to be ready to learn new things. But it's also true. I think the important thing is adaptability. And even chess, what it gave me was traveling. It made me, I met a lot of well-traveled people, people who speak a lot of languages.
Sure.
And the thing is, these kinds of skills give you options. You might be able to work in many countries, for instance.
Got it.
So I know lots of players in Europe who could live, because they speak 4 or 5 languages, they could live anywhere. And that expands their job options.
Got it.
I feel that nowadays it's very hard to say what constitutes a safe career and what doesn't.
Right.
And even in a career where you think that people have it made, the way it works nowadays is that a very small sliver gets to do very well.
Hmm.
Some people get to do okay and some people will struggle. So I think you just have to be ready. You have to have a broad range of skills.
Hmm.
And I think you should not have a kind of resistance to learning, saying, oh, this is not my subject, this doesn't interest me. It's very hard. Even within chess, it's easy to get into this mentality where you say, well, this area of chess doesn't excite me. I'll stay focused on the stuff that I like doing.
Hmm.
But we might get into this later as well.
Sure.
I believe that you have to be less dogmatic about these things.
Got it. The other piece I'm curious about, Vishi, and the people I talk to is what gets formed in the early years of growing up. You spoke about your mom introducing you to chess. But again, if I had to sort of step back and just ask you, what were some of the other, let's say, things or approaches to life or attitudes that got built in you, which have helped you in the journey this far? Are there 3-4 things that stand out in your, let's say, first 12 to 15 years, which got baked into you?
I guess I got most of my values from my parents. My parents were quite protective. My mother would accompany me to tournaments till I was 16, 17. And then after that, she came for some of the big ones, mm-hmm. even if she didn't travel with me everywhere. So I had this typical phase when I was maybe 15, 16, where I wanted to go alone as well. And you know, you're a teenager, you want to explore a bit. And so my mother probably, you know, felt this and didn't stop coming everywhere.
Sure.
But certainly my parents came, it might have been there in the back of their mind that too much independence and you may get into bad, you may pick up bad habits and things like that. So my habits and my attitudes are probably very similar to my parents in the sense.
Mm-hmm.
There were things that would never even occur to me. There were, within my own range of adventure, there are things that I would feel comfortable experimenting with, things I wouldn't, and so on.
Sure.
I feel it in my chest that I'm quite pragmatic.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not very adamant in a certain way that I'm, you know, if someone else has a good idea and it works for them, then I'm willing to copy it.
Very interesting.
I have a ability to improvise and, you know, I have no problems borrowing ideas.
Hmm.
Some people come with a very scientific bend of mind where, you know, it's their concept, their idea, that works.
Hmm.
It's not about success or failure. It's just that whatever works for you.
Hmm.
But because I came from a non-scientific background for chess.
Understood.
In chess, it as India used to play it in those days, everything is spontaneous. So I would say I was sensible and pragmatic.
And you sort of attribute that to the, sort of the context in which you grew up.
Yes, I mean, in my time, there was no chess coaching and things like that. So everything I learned, I had to pick up on the fly.
Got it.
And that means that you're comfortable with a certain level of improvisation.
Hmm.
And of course, I've changed heavily since that. I mean, as I got to the top, I had to learn other skills. And perhaps now I'm more comfortable in well-prepared areas and things like that.
Got it.
But I think that was the base.
Got it. The other thing I'm curious about, Vishi, is just there's this notion of what got you here wouldn't get you there as people scale up, let's say in the corporate world. And you need to pick up new skills for you to scale the next mountain. If you reflect on your journey, let's say for a minute, if I pick GM as a point, you were GM by the time you were 17, I think. Just to take that as an example, or maybe when you became world champion, talk to us a little bit about how your approach to growth has changed. Maybe if you just reflect on that phase and maybe the other critical inflection points.
Well, we have found that chess players tend to be good in certain things.
Mm-hmm.
The obvious connection you would make is, are they good in mathematical things? Because chess looks like a very logical mathematical game. Are they good in scientific stuff? I would say yes. Chess players are probably slightly overrepresented in those fields.
Mm-hmm.
But I know many chess players are excellent in languages as well.
Mm-hmm.
What I think chess players are very good at is at looking at a lot of information.
Mm-hmm.
And working with those patterns. So wherever these patterns tend to be useful, so in things like financial trading,
mm-hmm.
A lot of chess players moved into those fields.
Mm-hmm.
Because it looks very similar to this flood of new games from which you try to draw conclusions, and this flood of data about anything, and you work with that.
Sure.
It trains you to focus on one subject and stay in that subject till you've gotten an answer.
Mm-hmm.
And these are things that happen unconsciously over the chessboard, and then you carry over these skills elsewhere.
Sure.
I was quite surprised when I was in my early 20s, because it was clear to me that I was going to make a living as a chess player.
Mm-hmm.
I found quite a lot of my junior colleagues and all dropping out. Mm-hmm. They would become a grandmaster. Then a couple of years later, they wouldn't be so active for a while. And then a couple of years later, it would turn out they'd become bankers or far fewer lawyers, bankers. You can see this. They could go for a traditional career, but not that traditional. Something like trading suits this chess mentality. And they always said that one of the biggest strengths for people, or some chess players got into poker as well, all of them usually said one of the things that chess taught them was objectivity. So this idea that a position is only what it is. If you played well until that point, your position's good. If you played badly until that point, your position's not good. And so they said they were surprised how many people in poker, for instance, or trading just felt lucky and did this or that. And for chess players, it was, you know, if my past moves were good, then I'll have a good position. It was very...
devoid of emotion, right? It's just sort of...
Yes, and also this idea that almost like good and bad. If you had played well, then... you would have a good position. There was almost a kind of justice supplying there. And they said that made them very strong because they tended not to get emotional or... In other sense, in another way, even though they were in fields where you could gamble, they tended not to gamble. Or only gamble when they really felt the odds were favoring them, that sort of thing. Or gamble when the position was desperate. I mean, it influenced their thoughts in a certain way.
Okay.
But also there are many chess players who got into research. Because again, the university side of things, where you get used to this. Chess players generally are uncomfortable with other chess players. I think it's wrong to say they don't have social skills, but they have a certain kind of social skills. There are certain situations they're comfortable in. What you associate with nerdiness, I mean, it's an overused word probably, but... and so chess players gravitate naturally to those environments. A very controlled setting, because chess is a game played with quite rigid rules. So you tend to gravitate towards settings like that, and they feel uncomfortable in areas like entrepreneurship and so on, because that calls for a totally different kind of skill set. So I find that far more chess players are these kinds of things than that, though perhaps the chess players who know a bit about coding might straddle these worlds.
Got it.
Just a quick pause here. It's interesting to hear Vishy talk about the key capabilities one builds in a certain career and reflecting on the different canvases that one can apply it to. Having that self-awareness and abstracting the key themes can be super critical in transitioning from one orbit to another and in course corrections. In one of my earlier conversations, Nandan Nilekani spoke about the notion of individual competitive advantage and how he transitioned from the world of politics in the context of the elections in Bengaluru to being a key catalyst in the fintech ecosystem.
So I, after the election campaign and after that, I realized that this was not where I want to be, that I didn't have the leverage, I didn't have competitive advantage in that area. I didn't think I would be very effective. So I realized that actually my effectiveness comes from being what I'm good at, which is a technology-led transformation agent, and use my talents and abilities to solve large, intractable problems and make that available to anybody who wants to use it. So that was my shift.
You can find these nuggets at playtopotential.com. Now, back to the podcast conversation with Vishy Anand.
But back to your journey, Vishy, again, if we go back to becoming GM, did your approach to preparation or your approach to your game change significantly? What changed at that point in time?
I would say that as I climbed higher in the chess world, I realized that there were some skills that I was simply lacking, and I had to come. So I started to work seriously with a trainer before my first candidates match. So this is the candidates cycle for the world championship. And that's when I first started to work with a trainer. And that's interesting because for the first time, you don't just have an idea and you go to the board. You're trying to impose some discipline on the process by which you come up with new ideas and things. Because in chess, everything that's new gets old very fast. So it's the stream of ideas. Now, 50 years ago, it was very slow. And then it kept speeding up, and now with computers and the internet, it's sped up insanely. But nonetheless, the first time you work with a trainer, you learn that there are totally different opinions and perspectives to yours. You realize that there are strong people who argue strongly for the moves you didn't see, and you try to learn from that. And then when I won my first match and I qualified to play Karpov, I worked with a Russian player. Again, the idea was I could benefit from the Russian training methods because they were the most sophisticated and advanced in this area. And I would say more recently, I've had to learn some of, reorient my style towards spontaneity and creativity again, essentially almost back to where I came from, because we've sort of come full circle. Now, maybe I over-prepare and then you need to rebalance that. So, I think the big change was clearly in my 20s when I first started working with trainers. And then suddenly chess is a very structured thing. And that was a big change for me.
And one thing I'm curious about is how people pick trainers, or if I use the term coaches in the corporate world. Having worked with different players, is there a, what have you learned in terms of picking a good trainer or a coach from the wisdom of your journey?
I would say, and this is quite easy, because when you pick someone to be close to, especially as a chess player, I mean, in a corporate environment, there are some buffers between you and the next person. So if you don't like someone, you still get to go home and he goes home and you don't have to see him for a day. And there are also the other people at the office. There are buffers. But in chess, it's much more raw, because if you don't get along with your trainer, then you're really stuck with each other. It's almost marriage style for that duration. So first thing is you must get along well with these people. Then I think it's very useful to have trainers who disagree with you, because they will challenge your viewpoints, and or trainers who are good in areas that you're weak in. I mean, you may be a better player than them overall, but that may mean that you're good in seven areas and they're good in three areas, and those three areas are your weak suits. So you still can learn from someone who's who's weaker than you in competitive chess, but not in necessarily in training or understanding of chess. So that's the mix I tried to adhere to. Later on, I found that even though there are some people I really like, I genuinely like them as friends and so on, that they were reinforcing unhealthy qualities in me. So like if I'm cautious in certain situations and I'm trying to break out of that, the last thing I need is a trainer who's cautious there as well. Because you'll tend to reinforce your bad habits. So you should also see what it is you're trying to learn, what exactly you're trying to achieve with that training camp. And I would say subsequently, there are people who are friends of mine, so but who also... they have certain quirks that make you uncomfortable all day. But I have found that that can be healthy too. People who leave you slightly unsettled the whole day, well, I found that sometimes my work is better as a result, because there might be moments when you're annoyed with them and you work harder or something like that. So I would say that you should be focused on, first of all, getting along. Second, an openness to receive ideas. And third, to question your working ways. When my trainers first started to disagree with me, the first reaction is from your ego. Your first reaction is, that's my idea and you said it's not good. I'm going to sit and defend my idea. But if you can lose that and think, well, why do I have these trainers for at all? And then you think, well, I have... let me see if their idea is good or not, and let me argue this based on objectivity. Then you can learn something. So it's important to have to be able to watch yourself from above, so to speak, have a perspective on whether you're learning something. But at least in a narrow environment like chess, then it should really be about people you can see yourself spending a couple of weeks with.
And you alluded to another thing which is profoundly shaped a lot of the world of work and continues to, technology, right? Again, if you look at the disruption of technology in chess, just from a preparation and a scaling up standpoint, from a development standpoint, how How has technology fundamentally altered your approach to scaling up as a chess player?
Okay, the first technological, let's say, intervention into chess came in the late 80s when databases started to come.
Mm-hmm.
So already the people who were good in indexing information and who could organize information in a certain way, these were people who knew how to take all the games that were being published, index them, able to immediately find the
retrieve it.
Yeah, retrieve the information they're looking for. But this is not just a skill. I mean, even a librarian doesn't only have the skills you think they have. What they have is they know enough about the subject that they're able to look for what they need. And if they don't know the subject matter very well, they'll still be able to find what an expert would find. It's like that. So when computers came along, suddenly the people who was good in chess because of this started to fall back a bit, because that their skill set wasn't the most relevant here. With a computer, I could just click, type. If I knew how to use the search field well, I could find what I was looking for.
That comparative advantage was taken away.
Yes. Then the second trend which came was the chess playing program started to appear.
That is a Deep Blue and the equivalent, is it, or is it different?
Well, I'm talking the very, very basic versions of this. I mean, also, Deep Blue was on a mainframe, so we'll get to that. These are very weak chess playing programs. And at the beginning, they would go like 4 or 5 moves in every direction. They were thorough, but that's all they could do. So you tended, anything a grandmaster would see into the future would tend to be more accurate than what they did. But they were very good at, essentially as very basic calculators. You use them to eliminate little errors. Then as slowly they started to get better, so the kind of calculations they could check for you improved a little bit, and then they improved a little bit more. And then this Deep Blue match happened. But Deep Blue was very special because of running very specialized hardware, which couldn't be recreated for anyone. So even though Deep Blue existed, and in theory this machine existed somewhere in the world which was stronger than chess players, it didn't affect you right away.
It wasn't accessible to people.
Yeah. Right. Whereas now, if there's a computer somewhere which is stronger than everyone, the chances are they'll let you use it on the internet. That delivery mechanism simply didn't exist back then. So, but right after Deep Blue, I would say within a couple of years, maybe 3-4 years in the max, your laptop became stronger than you. Which means that it'll beat you in any single game that it plays. But you may make a better move here and there over the computer, but it's still, over a game, it would make fewer mistakes than you did and tend to win. Now that against, and what has happened subsequently, because now these programs have just run the course, but it's the same essential process. We have had to withdraw. We have had to concede space to the computers. So they got better in this, then they got better in that, then they got better in that. And first they got better in the things that you thought computers are good at. But then they started to get better in things that we thought we were good at.
Such as?
Long-term calculation, judgment, intuition. So we generally think of intuition as something slightly long-term process. So if I make a move and the reason for that move is 10 moves down the line, that you would tend to associate with intuition. Well, computers got good in that as well. They started making long-term sacrifices, long-term plans, which turned out to be very good because their search depth was increasing, and so they were hitting further and further. There's nothing intelligent about these things. But it turns out chess is a game that can be that is perfect for them because very strict rules and an environment where they thrive. And so at first we're conceding space and we're moving along, but eventually it becomes a tool because as computers get stronger and stronger, anybody who consults them can benefit from the information. So what differentiates one chess player from another starts to change a lot.
Correct.
And suddenly if you're not adapting your way of working, you find yourself even players are much weaker than you are neutralizing you. And because they're using the computer to cover their weaknesses and
so what this do you is do? This is advanced chess or regular chess?
No, regular chess.
Regular chess, okay.
The thing is, if I want to play an opening, today against some player, and he prepares three lines with the computer and he checks them precisely, and then he comes and plays them against you, how are you going to improve on it? Even if you are very good in that area, even if your intuition is very good, if he's worked it out, he's worked it out. So, yeah, and that became a problem. So, over time, you have to learn to use the computer more. So, as the computer becomes stronger and stronger, you change your work methods. That involves getting rid of your ego, because your what worked 5 years ago just no longer works, and you have to just get rid of it. I mean, a working method I'm talking about. And that's more or less where we are driven to today. And nowadays, it's almost extreme. People have adapted themselves completely to, I mean, computers are now so strong, they find in seconds or maybe minutes what it used to take us to a couple of weeks to find. That's the speed of calculation. So what do? It no longer makes any sense to specialize in anything. Because computers, a guy who has never seen that opening will be able to catch up with you in 1 week. And then what's your... So nowadays, most modern chess players are incredibly flexible. They're able to switch in time. They play everything, what they specialize, what they don't specialize. They move around a lot. And it's becoming about not what you bring to the table, but what can you remember? Can you organize this all this new flood of information in a different way? And what keeps you stronger? And then you shift your skills further and further into the end game and middle game, because it's harder for the computer to prepare it all that way.
Very interesting. And if I may, a related question is, if I look at the characteristics of a top-ranked chess player today, as compared to the characteristics of a top-ranked chess player, let's say 20 years ago, are there, let's say, fundamental differences in the traits and characteristics which lead you to success today than earlier, given the spread of technology?
Yes, I mean, I've already answered this point thing. I will just summarize it like this. Chess players today are much more flexible. They're much less ideological or dogmatic. Strange word in the chess context, but I'll explain. In chess, we used to grow up with these concepts like bring your pieces out to control the center. Don't move the same piece twice till you've developed all your pieces. Once upon a time, these were very good rules, and we used to call them the laws of chess almost, because they were very good strategies for winning games. But as it turns out, these are not rules as much as statistical phenomenon. So bringing your pieces to the center turns out to be a good strategy because it often is correct. But chess players are no longer so rigid. Now anything works. So there, modern chess is constantly about moves that I think would offend purists from 50 or 100 years ago. I'm sure that if somebody from 100 years ago came and looked at us today, he would just say, but this is ridiculous. How can you make such a move? But you have to just wipe the slate clean and learn a new way of thinking. So chess players today will do anything. They're so flexible because they've learned, and computers, what they show is eventually they show enough exceptions to show that any rule is only an approximation. It's not a rule. It's not like a law of physics, which always works. It's an approximation. These are good strategies. But now people are so, they're much less dogmatic. And second thing is chess players are now obsessed with fitness. Because if what differentiates you is simply your ability to play a long game, you know, you can't bring a greater understanding to the table, but you can play over a long time, then you need to be fit. So again, the skill set has been evolving.
Very interesting. And just on the fitness part, why is it more important today than it was earlier? I'm just curious.
So what happens is as the weight of the struggle shifts from the early part of the game to the later parts of the game, well, first you have to get to the later parts of the game. So, and by the time you get there, you get tired. So if you're fitter, you'll be able to concentrate well into your fifth hour, into your sixth hour and seventh hour. So one of the things that happened was chess players stopped agreeing draws quite so quickly. Because earlier the thing was, well, he's probably going to make the best moves. I'm probably going to make the best moves. But now we don't have the luxury of getting advantages all the time. So you have to play the end game till the end. And if you do that, then the fitter ones tend to do well. The other thing is, there's a qualitative difference as well in the way chess players work. I mean, because now we're following 100 openings instead of 5, our workload has increased enormously.
Correct.
And remembering all that, putting it all into context, trying to recall what you need at the board, all that is taking energy. And during the course of a game, it drains you. And if you're not fit, you'll make mistakes. So, Vishy, I want to move to a different topic, trying to get into the decode the mind of a champion, if you will. One of the pieces I'm curious about is the role of the left brain and the right brain in being an effective chess player. And how do you draw in on the two? And I say this, you alluded to the notion of instinct and intuition. But talk to us a little bit about how much of the meticulous planning gets coupled with sort of the pattern and the big picture thinking, which might be beyond the left brain capability.
Well, let me follow this rough terminology. My left brain is trying to have some sort of piece of control on the chessboard.
Right.
And my right brain is, let's say, what deal with when you lose control. So, I mean, I will describe it in those terms. So, I don't consciously break it down in that way, but mostly chess players would prefer to win an easy game than a hard game, would prefer to win without effort than effort, or rather, to put it differently, would prefer that the effort was at home in the training camp rather than at the board with the uncertainty involved. So, everything which will fall under control, you will think of with the left. By that, I mean things which are already well known to everyone. I mean, there's this huge mass of knowledge that already exists about chess.
Mm-hmm.
You want to be able to work on that and then recall what you need at the moment that you need it. I mean, there are so many examples of people losing a game because they know the evaluation correctly. They may even know the idea, but they don't know it exactly.
Mm.
And if you don't know it exactly, it's very difficult. You might slip up in the execution. So that, but that generally broadly speaks of control. So when you play against someone, you would like the game to develop along the lines of what you prepared this morning.
Hmm.
And so that is the systematic work. That's the work you work on during a training camp. You try to get the work out of the way. You check as much things meticulously and so on. But you should always be ready because you're basically playing against someone.
Mm-hmm.
Who's trying to get you out there in the open.
Hmm.
He's trying to get you out of your comfort zone and he's trying to make life difficult for you.
Mm-hmm.
And so he has the same knowledge that you have. So it's very easy for your opponent to think, this is what Anand would have prepared. How do I get him out? And so he's looking for unusual ways to surprise you.
Sort of game theory, right? In a way.
Right.
Yeah.
And so if he does that, you should be ready for surprises.
Right.
Now, that means that when you learn a subject, even any part of chess that you plan to use for the next round or the next week or whatever, it's not enough to just remember or get a grip on the existing knowledge because everyone has that. And that doesn't differentiate you. Chances are you'll be dropped very soon into something which you hadn't looked at before. How do you deal with those problems? So the thing is, when you work, you can't only work on problems that lend themselves to solutions.
Got it.
You have to think more broadly and think, how do I train my skills in such a way that I can develop a feeling for this class of positions so that whatever turns up, I'll be able to find the best moves. So you have to do a bit of both. For the second skill, for the right brain, what do? You play a lot of 5-minute games, blitz games. You do problem solving. Problem solving is they are trying to find very unusual patterns. And the more unusual patterns you find, you're training your brain to think in unusual ways. So again, when you look at a position, how many candidate moves do you think of? If you normally think of 3, but after some problem solving training, you're able to think of 5, that's very healthy because you'll pick up more unusual moves.
Understood.
So, you have to balance your work in such a way that not only are you getting the proper work done,
mm-hmm.
which is essential, by the way. The existing base of knowledge you have to learn to play and you have to learn to play it well.
Mm-hmm.
But you also have to train the skills that you'll need to just cope with unexpected circumstances. And last but not least, the psychological aspect. There is no use having all the creative skills in the world if when the moment comes that you have to go into the unknown,
mm-hmm.
you enter it with trepidation.
Mm-hmm.
Because then you've lost half the battle before it's thing.
Mm-hmm. it's not utterly hopeless, because still, if the position turns in your favor, you'll recover and whatever. But you must be psychologically ready for battle. That means the moment you have a chance to break free from the known areas and you go out there and you fight, you have to be ready and enthusiastic, if you like, about facing this unknown challenge.
And how do you build that capability, the psychological capability?
I think you try to play as often as possible. You, if your opponent is an uncomfortable opponent for you, then against that opponent, you'll tend to gravitate towards safety. And if you want to break that pattern, you'll have to figure out a way to do it. You might want to rethink the whole method of how you approach risks. But it's a mixture of things. Sometimes people will go to the board completely ready to take a risk. At the last minute, they will suddenly start seeing everything that's wrong with what they plan to do. And then they'll do the safe thing and come back. And then they realize that all the things that they thought were wrong were wrong. Were themselves wrong. So in fact, they could have gone ahead with what they planned. And what is going on here? The thing is, psychologically, you don't want to enter an area that's risky. So at the moment you want to, your brain almost tricks you. It gives you arguments for going back to the safe and predictable course, which at that moment seem logical to you. So you justify it on the terms that you're saying, I'm going to be playing logically. I'm doing the logical thing here. And then you come back home and you realize you were covered. So you have to, you can learn by example. You can play a lot of blitz games. You can play training games. There are many ways to do this. You can study players who have the desired qualities that in that area. But it's often a psychological problem. It's not just, nothing in chess is easy to break down. So again, one of the things I feel that chess has taught me is that very far from controlling your brain, your brain is a wild horse there. And you need to work with it. You need to work with it. Sometimes it'll betray you. And it's operating according to its own clock, its own schedule. You can't impose control on that. And so creativity partly is learning how to understand that you will lose control. So I've often alluded to this thing of losing control. Losing control can happen at many levels. Psychological, you can feel uncomfortable with playing something, and so on. And so in chess, it's not enough to focus on the skills you can learn. There are also the skills you must become intelligent. I'll give you one quick example. I would often get to move 40, and move 40 is significant because it's the end of the first time control, which means that you get a fresh amount of time on your clock, and you, normally your time pressure is over. But a lot of people, the moment, the time between move 32 and 40 is so tense, and they're so caught up in it, they're not able to stop. They'll make the 41st move anyway. And especially once upon a time, I was very prone to this error. And I was also prone to an error that when I had half an hour and my opponent had 3 seconds, I would try to play faster that he wouldn't have any time to think. It doesn't take a lot of intelligence to stop yourself and see that if you play fast to not give him any time to think, you're not giving yourself any time to think either. So these were two areas where I had problems. And one of the things I did was I would simply make a mental note. I would think of some painful loss I had suffered as a result of these habits. So that when I went to the board, when I was on move 35, my opponent down to 3 seconds, he's shaking and the temptation is overwhelming. And I have half an hour, so I'm in no pressure. I would just tell myself to get up, go to the refreshment area, have a little bit of water or some coffee, and then I'd come back. And I found that this broke the tension. I stopped, I had become too emotionally bound in the game, and this broke that. And then I was able to bring some sanity to the process. And especially doing this after move 40, when neither of us is in any tension anymore, but just getting up, going away, and leaving it for 10 minutes, and then you come back, and you find that it resets your brain almost. So that's one technique, but there are techniques like this that you learn, you know, they're part of your bag of tools. And your toolkit, and that's how it works.
Very interesting. And you spoke about, you know, organizing information. I'm curious about how you organize information in your head. And at least the way I think about it, there are two things, right? One is you need to have a database in your head of the various games that have been played and the research you've done, maybe specific to an opponent as well. And you need to have processing capacity to deal with new situations that come up.
Right.
So how do you organize your processor? In the sense, is there something that you've learned over the years in terms of not overloading with data that you don't have space for processing power? Is that a trade-off there, or is that a false trade-off?
I've never thought of my brain in terms of hard disk capacity. There's a limited amount of space that I'm going to work with. But it's like this. I have come to the conclusion that you can't manage your brain in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
But what you can do is to create the conditions that are ideal, where you've found in the past it tends to flourish. Mm-hmm. And you create those conditions, and so you follow the kind of habits that work well. Like, for instance, this habit of breaking on move 40 worked well for me.
Very interesting.
It meant I dropped the emotional baggage of the first 40 moves.
Mm.
Now, a lot of people may not understand what is emotional baggage in chess. So, in a chess game, you can go through a lot of twists and turns. I might have been winning, then suddenly I blundered, and then I was lost, and now my opponent blundered, and now I'm back in the game and thing. So here there's a lot of accumulated things. You're first kicking yourself for not winning your one position. You're thinking, I shouldn't even be having to play this now. But then you realize that you were lost as well. And then you realize that, but now the thing is, the only position you'll ever have in the board is the one in front of you now.
Right.
That's the only thing you can do anything about. So you have to have this habit of breaking it. Now, overnight sleep is nice, but in this case, you have to find some way to break it. And I believe that it's important to keep the brain excited about chess, passionate about chess. So if you keep on looking at new positions, you look on things that interest you, or you look at difficult things that didn't come to you, if chess keeps fascinating you,
mm-hmm.
then chances are, then when the time comes to process, it'll process. When the time comes to remember, it'll remember.
Got it.
If people in the audience just want to know what is that in a very, very basic sense, try to see your recall in subjects that interest you, and try to see the recall in subjects that don't interest you.
Hmm.
And you'll understand what I'm talking about.
I hear you. The other piece I'm curious about, Vishy, is judgment. Right? You spoke about that in the context of machines in the earlier section, which is what makes sense, all things considered. What can the business world learn from the world of chess in making sound objective judgment? Objectivity was another piece you spoke about. How do you think about judgment when you have multiple options to choose from? How do you pick the one that sort of makes sense for you at that point in time?
The first thing you learn in chess is you make the best move, because that is the best.
Mm-hmm.
Then as you get up the ranks, you learn that the best move might not always be what you require. What you require is the most uncomfortable move for your opponent.
Hmm.
Or you may find that a slightly better position in which you're very happy and comfortable and you feel everything inside out is better for you than a much better position that you don't feel completely comfortable in.
Mm-hmm.
So you learn to attune it a bit to your needs.
Mm-hmm.
But mostly, I think your judgment is just a collection of all your experience so far.
Right.
In some way that, in a process that you don't control.
Mm-hmm.
So you have all this experience, you have things, but it's very hard to tell what you will recall and what you won't and what you think. There are times when I'm astonished at my recall. And there are times I forget something I saw that morning. I try to make whatever I need to remember, I try to make as interesting as possible so that I will remember it. Or I look at it several times in such a way. Or one funny thing, when I was training, I would often ask my trainers to quiz me in things I tend to forget. And so they would know roughly what I tend to forget, and they would do that. And then when I couldn't recall what I'm supposed to do, sitting in front of a room with all of them looking at me as I'm struggling to recall was so embarrassing that when I went to the board, I remembered it. It's like that. You create the conditions for your brain to work well. And that, in a sense, is judgment.
Got it. And I guess, in a way, this ties up to the previous question as well. Are there rituals you practice to ensure that your sense of judgment and your processing power is kept at its fullest potential? What are the rituals you follow? You spoke about exercise, but otherwise, are there any mind or brain rituals that's worth discussing?
Some things. I mean, I found that a good night's sleep is very helpful. Especially a sleep which is not disturbed. Because we're not talking of rest as much as the ability to put the more nervous energy and the emotions from the previous day away, so that when you wake up, you're looking at a fresh day. That works well. So then I work backwards from that. And often after a very tense game, I try to go for a long walk, or I might even go to the gym. I'm not going for the exercise. I'm going there to tire myself so that I'll have a shower and then I'll just fall asleep. And I will not waste any energy thinking about the game. There are even players who prefer to do all their work at night. So they'll work till 5 or 6 in the morning even.
Wow.
And then go to sleep and wake up at 2 o'clock and go straight to the game without any further work. And what they're fighting is, if you wake up at 9 o'clock and your game is at 2 o'clock, then you're thinking, but if I can do this, but if I do this, he might do that. And if I do that, he might do this. And therefore, what should I do? And this could go wrong, that could go wrong. And you're using a lot of nervous energy thinking about this stuff. So what they're trying to accomplish by waking up at 2 o'clock is they have no time to worry about the game. They've done all their work the last night and then they've gone to sleep.
Understood.
In my case, that doesn't work because I can't stay awake till 6 in the morning. But I will try to get a good night's sleep, then wake up. I like to work for some time. I found that superstition normally comes with that. If you had breakfast at 9 in the morning and you won that game, you'll want to go at 9 the next day and this kind of stuff. Even though there should be no real connection. But you have to decide which is harmless and which is superstition that's driving you insane.
And the related piece I want to talk about, Vishy, was the conscious versus subconscious. And the reason I ask is, I remember listening into one of your earlier conversations where you talk about taking a break from the game. Maybe, I think it was in the context of schooling, where you would go back to your books and come back and look at the chessboard and it looked clearer. Again, I sort of relate that to what you said about some of the players practicing till 6 a.m. and then going to sleep. How do you think about sort of the conscious approach to preparation versus the subliminal processing that's going on? What's the take on that?
Well, the subliminal is, I think if you keep being fascinated by chess, you will see all the interesting and unusual things that happen. You'll recall it. Now, there is no way to say that at the right moment, you'll come up with the right idea. But by looking at a lot of material, you're increasing the chance that it'll probably be the right decision. I mean, if there's a critical mass of ideas, you'll probably find the right decision. So you do that. I try not to control that very much. I believe that it's important to learn almost like a child. If you're fascinated by a subject, it'll go in effortlessly. The subjects that bore you, you know. But then you have to do the reverse. In chess, you may not be able to avoid the subjects that bore you. So the thing is, how do you find a way of making that interesting? It can be against this guy I hate. I always lose this kind of position. So I'm going to work on this position, though I don't like it, because one day he will not beat me and I'll get satisfaction on that. You know, you can always work it backwards like that and do that. But I think you grow in chess and you learn in chess by being willing to learn new stuff. And I can't refine it more than that.
Very interesting. And just to pick, you've been at the top of the game for a pretty long time. And I love the point you make about making something interesting, even if it's not interesting on the face of it. How have you made chess interesting for yourself? Again, you also spoke about several people moving on to become bankers and lawyers and other things. So what's the secret of staying interested in a topic for this long? Or is it something that comes naturally to you?
Well, one thing is to take breaks from it. I mentioned many times that you hit a point where you're sick of the game. You've just been playing too much or studying too much. And then, you know, you go 1 month without even switching on the computer or touching a chessboard. And then you come back at the end of the month and suddenly you find a lot of the stuff that used to bore you has become interesting. So that's one thing.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing is to work on new stuff. I mean, working on old things, sometimes even if you have everything worked out, your brain forgets what you keep on working beyond a certain point.
Mm.
And so it's good to drop some things for a while, do other things, and then come back, and then you're okay. But if you're only doing one thing all the time, then it gets so routine that your brain stops being creative about it. It expects you to get by on muscle memory, and it's not a good thing to have. And that's how you keep it interesting.
Got it. And how do you infuse creativity? What are your pursuits outside of chess that sort of bring creativity to your chess?
Well, I listen to music, I watch other sports, I like astronomy.
Uh-huh.
So I have the subjects that I follow, I read, anything that allows you to disconnect from the game. Watch things on Netflix, whatever. House of Cards was nice for a while.
it's a bit of rough weather. Yeah. And I want to go back to a personal memory of mine. I happened to catch one of your games with Magnus Carlsen in Chennai at one of the hotels here. And I remember that game vividly. I think it was one of the longest games that has been played, if I vaguely remember. And he was walking around, but you had your concentration on the board and, there were, I think, a couple of moves that probably went into maybe longish periods of time, 20 minutes [S2] Sure. [S1] Or 30 minutes. I'm curious about what goes on, let's say, for a minute, if you took the longest move that you've ever made or the longest time you've ever taken to make a move, is the bulk of time evaluating different possibilities, or is it playing out scenarios and coming back? Just break that for us. How does the time get spent?
I think one of the longest things I've had is over an hour.
Wow.
In London once. And basically what had happened was that I had gotten into a bit of trouble. Then I realized I'm still very much in the game, but it's like it's full of minefields. I make a mistake here, I make a mistake there, it's over.
Mm-hmm.
And that particular think, you should normally not, you would not need an hour.
Mm-hmm.
When you're spending an hour, it means you're unable to think very clearly.
Mm-hmm.
So first, let's describe what thinking clearly is. Thinking clearly is saying, these are the four alternatives I have. Then you say, okay, A, this move. And then you follow A down to its logical conclusion. You see what you like, you come back, you do B, you come back, you do C, then you do D. Then based on the information you have, you make your move. You pick your one and you make your move. And if I had done that, I wouldn't have needed 1 hour. But what happens is you go down A, then you come back, you go down B, you come back, and suddenly you think, wait, I missed something in A. And you go back down A and you come back. And so a lot of this work is wasted because you're going over stuff you're already gone, but you think you have found something new here and there.
Mm-hmm.
That is what happens more often, because sometimes the brain needs to go down A, come back, and think about something else before, but in the background it's somehow working there and it'll find something.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if we could think an hour on every move, it would be a different game, but sometimes these critical moments you have to think like that. I think you can't try for perfection here. Like I said, the way your brain will present the answers is something you'll just have to getting used to. But you try to manage this as much as possible. Yeah, on the efficient days, you'll do a better job, and some days you'll just go over a lot of material again and again. Ideally, the thinking is very clear, and you see the essential and you reject everything else. But sometimes you get muddled.
Got it. Related question again, I have young kids, and one of the things we talk about is the digital distraction, which is 10x or 100x what was there about 20 years back. And chess is a great example of being mindful about one topic for a prolonged period of time. Is there anything to be said about staying mindful in this world of digital distraction? How do you try and stay mindful amidst all the distraction?
Well, I believe there are subjects where you will not attain any result unless you get to a certain level of concentration.
Right.
Like with my chess, I know that it's not enough for me to go to my computer, work for 5 minutes, and then go work somewhere else, then come back. I will not get any progress that way. I need to go switch on the chess, run the chess program, and work for maybe an hour before I understand the problems at a deep level, and then I'm able to find solutions. And so how do you bring that mindfulness to other things? It's very difficult. Sometimes technology is itself a help. I mean, I find it very useful. If there's something I think I won't remember about someone, I'll just write a memo to myself. And then if I see that memo a couple of times, then after 1 month, I'll have no difficulty remembering it. I mean, I found that it's very hard to remember all the things that you hear in this day and age. So that's useful. On the other hand, there are times I can see that I'm tapping my phone way more than necessary. And at home, at least, I'm aware from them. Quite often I fail, but I'm aware at least that if I'm constantly with my phone, I'm setting a bad example for Akhil. But when you're in an airport and you're bored and the flight is delayed, you have no control.
Sure.
And it's pointless. You keep on tapping your phone because you're... But it's a kind of device rage. It has nothing to do with any... there's just nothing coming out of it.
Right.
You're just surfing, I think, aimlessly.
Right.
With Akhil... We try to moderate it. There are times we know we have to let him enjoy himself, but at some point we have to control. We have to control the hours when he's allowed to use gadgets and things like that, because it's so easy to go wrong with gadgets, especially when you're the age where you can't see what's wrong with that.
Right.
So it's important thing. A couple of years back, we made a conscious decision to try and restrict his device usage in certain hours, and that was very nice. And now he's coping well. He's much better at it, so that's good.
Got it.
And again, the problem seems to be more us these days.
That's true.
Just a quick comment here. This reminds me of my conversation with Vinita Bali, a distinguished leader who's had a successful career across 6 countries and 5 continents. She spoke about her early childhood years, where she got exposed to several extracurricular activities, and how that has informed her leadership style. It was interesting that she mentioned that this exposure enabled her to see things in a continuum rather than discrete compartments, and helped her get her right brain and left brain capabilities to bear as a leader.
You know, as I think about it, I think the most significant part of thinking about things in multiple dimensions and not in a single dimension, or thinking about things systemically, I think comes from my exposure and my interest. I guess it was my exposure which led to my interest to a lot of things when one was growing up. So, you know, in school, I used to do sports. I used to do dramatics. I used to, for a long time, I was a student of Indian classical dance, which I pursued in the evening outside of school. So I was interested in doing everything, you might say. Not that I thought about it, but I was also, you know, the school selects a junior school captain and head girl and so on. So, you know, I was thrust into those roles. And those roles, in a strange way, come with their own responsibility, which seems like a lot when you're a school kid. So I think it was a combination of all of that and my exposure to the world of theater, to the world of classical music and dance, I think refined in many ways, my aesthetics or my thinking about things across a continuum, rather than fragmenting that this is school and this is extracurricular. In my life, everything morphed from one to another.
You might want to look up Nugget 16.02 on playtopotential.com if this is of interest. Marrying this back to Vishi's point, not only do these pursuits energize you by giving you a break, they can even help you in your co-pursuit, whether it's leading a business or pursuing a sport at the highest level. Now, back to my conversation with Vishi.
Just picking up on advanced chess, again, it seems to be a good parallel with the real world, where all of us can leverage the power of the machine, and then it's sort of man plus machine versus man plus machine.
I'm curious about what you think about the role of the human being in that context, right? When you have the best machines on offer on, let's say, on the cloud where anybody can access, then what's the competitive advantage that you bring to the table as a human being? What's your take on that? Where's the space for us to have a voice in that equation?
Man plus machine, advanced chess man plus machine versus man plus machine, has actually turned out to be a dead end.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going anywhere because machines have gotten to the point, I'll make this analogy, machines have become like incredibly fast cars.
Mm-hmm.
And let's say the best chess players are like athletes, which means that the athlete in its best ever moment is not going to have a slightest chance against a very fast car.
Mm-hmm.
Now imagine that advanced chess once upon a time was two athletes getting into their cars, being able to use their car and being able to intervene themselves when they felt it would help.
Hmm.
Now this would only work if your fuel is insufficient for the entire ride and a certain portion had to be driven.
Hmm.
And what happens now is that man plus machine versus man plus machine is just often machine versus machine. There's very little... It's very hard to know when your intervention is better than the machine.
Hmm.
And it's so infrequent that it's hard to pick out. And the point is, you may decide that your intervention is crucial, but if your rival is still using the machine, then you have to be sure that your human touch is not worse than what it's going to do. So that has turned out to be a dead end. However, chess has become spectacularly enriched by our ability to work with a machine at home and combine its ability to throw up unusual patterns, unusual ideas. I mean, one of the things that's forgotten sometimes is how rich chess seems now, because the machine has shown us how many things we had rejected which turned out to be possible.
Very interesting.
And how many areas we thought were closed forever have opened up again. I mean, if the machine is guilty of closing doors, it's responsible for opening far more doors than it's closed. And right now, it's a golden time in terms of how rich the game seems. And the other thing it's done is it's made chess accessible to everyone, because if anyone has the world's best coach, if a slightly not very expressive one, then every person on the planet has the world's best coach available for a price. And that means that once you know how to ask the right questions, you can get the right answers and you can grow.
Right.
So the learning process has become incredibly interesting. But unfortunately, advanced chess itself has turned out to be a dead end.
Very interesting. Very interesting.
Just a quick pause here. It's fascinating to see how technology is having such a profound impact on jobs and careers. I'm reminded of my chat with Atul Kasbekar, the celebrated photographer who's also a producer now. He talks about how the world of photography in some ways has gotten democratized given the penetration of smartphones.
You know, like when it comes to photography, it's there's a certain, like I like to call it, a democratization of the medium.
Correct.
And it's just become massively accessible to everybody. So on a given day,
right,
your doctor could take a world-class photo.
Yep.
You know, and by himself, aided with some filters, apps, etc., whatever it is, that photo is unbelievable. Point is that can he do that time and time again and day after day, you know, then I guess you'd be a great professional. But why I say this medium has become so democratic is because on a given day, the doctor can take a great picture, you know. On no day can you either prescribe medicine for one of his patients, nor can you perform a heart surgery.
The big question facing a lot of us is, how do we stay relevant in this context? It raises some fundamental questions around how we think about the where to go question. We need to ensure that what we're doing continues to be relevant in a world where machines are getting more and more intelligent. But the interesting bit is that the technology is also such a wonderful enabler as we think about the how to grow question. As Vishy says, it's so easy to access some of the best minds in any profession. The equation has clearly shifted from a world of scarcity of supply to scarcity of time, willpower, and attention when it comes to our development. And it's fascinating to see the technology being the giver or the taker, depending on the lens we choose to use to look at the situation. You can find these nuggets at playtopotential.com. Now, back to the podcast conversation with Vishy Anand.
And at the highest level today, what's your take on the capabilities and disciplines that separate the best from the rest? Again, one understands the chess-related preparation and the capabilities, but are there broader disciplines and capabilities that typically differentiate the top few from the rest?
Generally, the best players in the world make fewer mistakes. They tend not to make the last mistakes. And that often is psychological. Mm-hmm. They think they're not going to make the last mistake, so they don't make it. At that last moment, after 6.5 hours of struggle, they're suddenly able to summon up energy and concentrate 100%. The opponent is not able to. Chess was always down to these little factors.
Hmm.
And in fact, it has never changed, because in any game between two humans, these will be the decisive factors. So as long as both sides have been willing to adapt their way of learning to the most successful methods, these tend to be the differentiating factors still. So the best player in the world is someone who outclasses opponent.
Got it. I want to talk about the role of teamwork, even in a seemingly solo sport like chess. I mean, clearly the role of IQ in being a chess champion is often well understood. But talk to us about the role of EQ in being a great player at the top. How does it show up? In what ways does it show up?
I think EQ is being able to understand when, what are the circumstances that cause you to fail and what are the circumstances that cause you to succeed. And very often it turns out to be related to your mood, your attitude, your spirit, your ability to take risks.
Mm-hmm.
These things strongly correlate with your emotion. And as you get, I mean, when I was young, I tended to dismiss these things. You know, a good move is a good move is a good move.
Mm-hmm.
But as I got older, I realized that a good move may be a good move, but for me to make one, the circumstances have to be right. And I think with experience, you become more self-aware. You've seen this movie before. Mm-hmm. And you, I mean, you're not going to be able to predict it completely, but you can tell when what's a good day, what's not.
Got it.
So I think you just understand yourself better. You also learn how to control your unhealthy habits,
mm-hmm.
How to learn from other people, things like that.
Got it. And specifically, when you've had the history of having some of your competitors as team members, right? Whether it's Kramnik or Kasparov or even Carlsen briefly to help you prepare for games. Is there anything to be said about an approach to collaboration with fellow players that you've consciously adopted in your journey as a chess player?
Yes, over time I've learned that the first rule, I think, is actually well known, that you don't get in your own opinion first. Don't offer one. Because once you offer an opinion, you often spend a lot of energy defending your opinion rather than, even when you think it's wrong, you don't want to lose face. And so that, when my team would show me stuff, my first skill was to keep my mouth shut. Because if what they said turned out to be better, then it's better not to have opposed it in the beginning.
Hmm.
I find that in the sense I'm more open to contradictory opinions or people who disagree with me violently, because I realize, well, that's kind of the path to understanding.
Mm-hmm.
Over long periods of time, you learn how moody people are. You see the real side.
Mm.
And you need a certain kind of tolerance with that. You need a sense of how good or bad or pleasant or annoying you can be.
Mm.
What people may like in you in day one may not be what they like in you in day seven, and you have to be aware of that.
Mm.
I think you perceive these things much better. So over a long camp nowadays, I'm able to tell if I'm grating on my trainer or he's grating on me. And it's not perfect still, but you know, you get better at those things.
Mm.
And in the end, if you create the most congenial atmosphere, you'll produce the best ideas.
Got it. Just a quick comment here.
The notion of speaking last that Vishy talks about when you have a team is an interesting switch that a lot of leaders struggle with, especially when they transition from a CXO role to a CEO role. High IQ and expertise often gets people to the top of a function, where you're often celebrated for your content spike, and structurally, you're often the most informed person in a room on a topic. But when you become the CEO or a GM of a division with multiple functions reporting in, you often need to lead people who often know a lot more than you in their domain. And that requires a completely different leadership style with a heavy dose of listening and collaborative problem solving. This is all the more relevant in today's world where there are so many unknown unknowns that CEOs are often doing themselves a huge disservice if they don't listen enough to the people around them. Now, back to the podcast conversation with Vishy Anand.
Just some overall themes on your journey, Vishy. And if you had to be really modest with yourself and talk about what has helped you this far, you know, and sustain your performance at the highest level for this long, what would you attribute it to?
I mentioned this very early, that when I was young, because of the way chess was thing, I was very flexible and I was not very dogmatic or rigid in my views. So I would say my biggest skill is flexibility. I'm generally open to changing my approach if something hits the wall. I'm a hard worker. I think I work hard because chess interests me. So I'm not sure I'll work hard in something that bores me, but I'm a hard worker at least for chess. And that includes, you know, learning to maintain my fitness and things like that. And I think chess has partly helped in this regard, but I'm quite open to learning new skills. Learning from other people. I mean, when I observe other people and you think that's impressive, then I try to see how I can apply that in some way. I'm conscious of what I think I'll be able to apply and what I don't. And so my fourth is maybe I'm fairly realistic. Many people have made suggestions. One of the suggestions was, I think a psychologist will be good for you. And I rejected that out of hand because I knew that I felt that it wouldn't work for me. It's a good idea. There are people who will benefit from it, but I felt it wouldn't work for me. And I said, no, I don't want to do this. And I think that was a good example. Things like that. So I have a good sense of how to learn. And I'm willing to work hard. I think I'm flexible in my approach. Fairly pragmatic, if you like.
I mean, the other piece that a lot of CEOs think a lot about is staying calm through the ups and downs. Again, what's been your approach to staying level-headed through the, let's say, as the tables turn in a game? You spoke about it briefly, but is there something to be said about a mindset with which you look at a situation for you to stay level-headed through a game?
For some people, it comes naturally. I remember they would always say about Karpov that for him, the game always began in the current position. And what this means that Karpov could be lost in the whole game. And in some people, if you're lost the whole game, then they're already dreaming of a draw, so that if the position turns violently and they suddenly have a chance to win, they're not able to adapt. And they still try to nail the draw.
Right.
Rather than take the extra point that's been given. Because the phase when they were threatened with a defeat is so strong, they're not able to completely forget it. Karpov would switch on a dime. He'd be lost this move, he'd be winning in the next move, and he would just start playing for the win. So he was able to forget his emotions. Again, these things are exaggerated. Of course, Karpov couldn't always do this, and the rest of us, if the winning opportunity was easy enough, we would have taken it and so on. But within limits, that requires almost a certain kind of cold-bloodedness. I'm not very good at this, but I'm aware that I'm not very good at it. And I think being aware of what you should be looking out for in a game is one healthy method. For staying calm in the game, I find that the healthiest is just, like I mentioned earlier, the move 40, the same example, is to break the link, which means you have to get up, give your brain a few minutes to get used to the new situation, and then there's a kind of cleansing feeling when you say, okay, what happened happened. Now my job is to fight for a draw. No ego but the fact that I was winning before. Now my job is to fight for a draw. I'm going to fight for a draw. And then, you know, whatever it is you have to do, you try to think of how happy your opponent will be if he beats you, or how miserable you'll be, and or how happy he'll be if you deprive him of his this free point that he's getting, or what someone else. You find some hook which allows you to think, and then you go with that. But maintaining a calm during a tournament is one of the great skills in chess, and it's a very much a work in progress for me.
I want to pick up on a different theme, Vishy, which is your ability to stay incredibly grounded despite your towering successes. And two questions here. One is, how have you managed to stay that way? And second is, in a way, when you think about your son Akhil growing up, he's growing up in a very different context given your successes. How do you ensure that he grows up with the same set of values?
Well, what am I supposed to do exactly differently? I sort of understand what you're saying, but I found that quite a lot of people that are famous or successful remain in some fundamental way the way they are. I think it's connected to upbringing. My parents brought me up in a certain way. There were certain things that they did, and there were certain things that are obvious that they wouldn't do. And you kind of approach it like that. And essentially, with your family, with your schoolmates, you can't suddenly act differently, because they'll immediately just say, well, what's wrong with you? So you have to act normal. With fans and so on, it's not like I make a huge effort, but I make an effort to be friendly and nice, because at some level I'm aware that I have a job because of them. I don't think it's not obvious to me what exactly I should do differently. There are times I feel that I'm trying too hard to be nice, and the people are invading my space, and then sometimes the next time I'll try to impose it a bit more.
Sure.
But generally, I do what I'm comfortable with, and I'm a fairly relaxed person as such. And I don't like getting in conflicts with people, and so I gravitate to that approach.
Got it.
As for Akhil, I hope we'll bring him up like that. And the idea is, I think we'll try to show him that, first of all, by example.
Hmm.
And also, we'll try to make him value what we think are the most important things in life. Not the frivolous and superficial, but what's really important. And once it's important, then that's what you aim for.
Hmm.
For the moment, he's a very innocent kid, just very curious, and I think so it's quite easy to do it so far.
Hmm, got it. And I want to talk about dealing with losses, Vishy. Again, what's been your approach to dealing with losses? And if I may ask the question differently, what has been the best loss for you in terms of what you learned the most from? Is there something that stands out for you?
That's very hard. I don't think there's a loss you enjoy or learn from. I believe that a loss will almost always, because of the shock effect, force you to question everything that you had kind of assumed for a while.
Mm.
And it makes you uncomfortable in a very good way. So losses are good, but they by no means get easier with experience. In fact, if anything, I'm much worse at losing now than before. I mean, nowadays, people say you seem like a very well-behaved loser. But inside, I'm dying. I'm just waiting to get to the room and hit my head against a wall or something. But, you know, you're frustrated. And how do I cope? I try to get a grip on myself. I know that when it's important to sleep and play the next game well.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, if you have a rest day or your tournament is over, then you react differently.
Hmm.
Because then you can let go a bit slower. But otherwise, subconsciously, you learn to focus on the next game because you have to clear the baggage from this one.
Hmm.
And it may force you to work a bit harder for a while, and the pain will help you more to work harder for a while.
Hmm.
I don't think I've gotten better in any way at handling losses.
Got it. And in a way, you alluded to this, right? Whether it's about clearing the emotional baggage during the game, you spoke about move 40, 41st move, or even dealing with a loss. Is there any technique you use to stay present, to sort of just focus on the moment at hand and forget the baggage? Is there...
Sometimes getting up, stretching your arms, stretching a bit, taking a couple of deep breaths, things like that help. Otherwise, I always say that you can't learn to calculate better. What you can do is show your brain enough examples that when the moment comes, it conjures up the right effect. I mean, I think there are many things in chess that you cannot solve simply by saying, I'm going to sit here and calculate. Because that's not how the human brain works. Essentially, it's the standing on the shoulders of giants thing. Once you've reached a certain level, you can stand on that level and then suddenly you'll see new things, which you would not have been able to see before. And like that, you get better. So if you see other people's games, it'll show new concepts. And once you've seen a new concept, it's easy to learn how to apply it creatively. But I don't think we can find things from scratch. Which is, and the same in any career. I mean, a scientist is hardly divining up new stuff. Based on a good study of the history of science, he's coming up with new ideas. And it's very similar in chess.
Got it. Moving to a different topic, Vishy, I'm curious about this notion of spotting potential. And this is also in the context of you being a board member at Olympic Gold Quest. What do you look for when you see a young athlete in any game, whether it's chess or other sport? What do you look for you to say this person will rise all the way to the top? Are there markers of potential that you look for, apart from the capabilities in that sport?
I think you look at some basic technical level, at least on the chessboard. If I see several good moves in a row or something like that, I mean, one good move can be accidental, but not five in a row. Then you might think, oh, that's interesting. It's not any single move. It's the fact that five of them were good. Then you think, oh, wait, that can't be accidental. Sometimes you look for attitude. If someone just sits there and is willing to grind away, well, that's a different kind of sporting skill, which also should be rewarded. With Olympic Gold Quest, it's actually a lot of data. But we take someone who's already been vetted, if you like. So someone who's already a national champ or a record holder or a Commonwealth thing. Then it's not like we're picking someone out of the blue. There's something there to work with.
Yeah.
And then Viren gets in touch. We try to evaluate their prospects. What are the steps they need to get better? What are the steps they need to qualify to compete in the Olympics? You know, what are the milestones along the way you expect them to do? What are their training needs? What are their financial needs, practical needs, things like that? How we can help? A lot of that. But we don't do so much talent spotting yet. We're doing more and more talent spotting now as we work with younger athletes. But while I can tell if someone is reasonably talented, I can never say how high they're going to go because there are so many things along the way that it becomes unpredictable.
Got it.
It's interesting to see that there are a few things that need to come into play for us to harness potential. Building on what Vishy says, one needs to look for a certain consistency in performance, coupled with an attitude to grind it out day after day over the long term. One also needs to put together a support plan or a development plan in a corporate context that's tailored to the need of the individual to fulfill their potential. In one of my earlier podcast conversations, Viren Raskina, who's played hockey for India and is now the CEO of Olympic Gold Quest, spoke about this in some detail. He spoke about what he looked for when he was trying to spot potential.
For me, a very important quality is the hunger and desire to be the best in the world. And not just being happy with being national champion or Commonwealth Games champion. We want our athletes to dream and have the desire to be the best in the world. And for that, we need to gauge whether are they ready to run through a brick wall for you every single day in training.
He also spoke about how at OGQ, they try to tailor the development plan, including the selection of the coach, to cater to a specific developmental need for the athlete to fulfill their potential.
How do you pick a coach in context to a player? So I'll answer it with Mary Kom's example.
Sure.
In 2009, women's boxing was introduced in the London 2012 Olympics for the first time ever. Mm-hmm. Mary was already a 5-time world champion winner, but in the 46 kilograms weight category and 48 kgs, mm-hmm. her last one. Mm-hmm. Now, when women's boxing was announced in 2009 that it would be for the first time in the London 2012 Olympics, before that boxing was only a men's sport.
Okay.
But the least weight category for women was 51 kilos.
Mm.
So that means Mary Kom, who was originally a 46 kg boxer, to move into 51, which is 2 weight categories higher.
Hmm.
It had been unheard of for a boxer to go 2 weight categories higher and win an Olympic medal.
Wow.
Now the challenge was, because when you're fighting in a weight category, not only you need to put on the right kind of weight, but you're fighting against taller opponents.
Sure.
Which is a major technical challenge in boxing. If you're fighting against taller opponents, that's a big challenge.
Hmm.
So we researched a lot, and found out a coach by the name of Charles Atkinson, who specialized in taking fighters up weight categories.
Fascinating.
And making them into world champions.
If I translate that to the corporate world, it implies that we need to have a razor sharp sense of the developmental need for a leader before we go and put together a development plan or pick a coach who's best in class for that issue. You can find these nuggets at playtopotential.com. Now, back to the podcast conversation with Vishy Anand.
And again, when we look at the sporting canvas, there are some canvases where there's a depth of talent in terms of a pipeline of talent emerging, and some sports where there are odd players here and there. What's your take on creating conditions to develop a pipeline of talent? What does it take? And the reason I ask, maybe just to qualify it, is even in companies, the holy grail is to create a pipeline of leaders, not sole stars here and there. So I'm curious about what lessons we can learn from the world of sport.
I honestly don't know. I mean, clearly you have the Soviet school of chess. You have the German football academies. You have the Barcelona football academy. You have tennis academies and things like that.
Right.
So there are examples of these things, but then there was nothing that anybody had done which should have created a Norwegian world champion, chess champion. I don't know anything that Switzerland did to get a great tennis player. For every story where you say, well, these were the steps followed, and you know, we can make a factory out of this, there is things that arise that just have no explanation. And I simply don't know what it is that's required. I mean, why on earth does Switzerland have such a good tennis player? Why on earth does suddenly Russia produce so many tennis players? There are just too many things that are not predictable. I think all you can do with an academy is to set a reasonable expectation, but that's it. Talent follows its own rules, I think.
Very interesting. And recently I was reading a book about parallels between real life problems and computer problems. I was just curious, are there big parallels you see between the chessboard and, let's say, the world of business? Again, it's a sort of a open question, but are there 2-3 lessons about, you know, approach to risk, approach to judgment, approach to decision making that can sort of translate to the world of business?
Oh yes, very much so. I mean, I find in chess it's very easy to get into this mentality of saying, this is what I'm good at. Therefore, the work I do in this area is likely to be the most productive. And therefore, I will work on what I'm good at. But then there will come a time when you'll have to work on things you're not good at. Because you don't know which is going to be the most successful area in a couple of years. And there are many examples of businesses which didn't change their focus in time or didn't adapt to some new trend. And they kept getting better and better at what they were good at. And suddenly they lost the plot completely.
Got it.
And it's very easy to get into a situation where you're used to seeing the world in a certain way. And then you're unable to break free of that. That both in chess and in business can be a big danger. In an organization, of course, you think there are a lot of people working. But even organizations can get into this thing of thinking in a certain way. So that process is not very difficult, different from an individual. And I think both with chess and businesses, you know, how you respond to success, how you respond to failure, not so much what happens then, but how what the trigger, the changes it triggers in you, those kinds of things are very important to keep track of. And if you can develop a culture of responding in the right way to events, then over time, it makes that easier. So when I say culture, even in chess, people who work regularly on things, people who think have better results than people who simply do it from time to time.
Got it.
So it has to be something that feels natural and becomes second nature.
Got it. So Vishy, in summary, this podcast is about people playing to their potential, and which is often about picking the right sport and doing the best at that sport. So in summary, any themes you want to leave the listeners with for them to play to their potential?
Yes, I alluded to this quite a few times during the podcast, which is that you tend to do something tends to be much easier if you're interested in it than if you're uninterested in it. And life is tough enough without you finding something that you're not good at or boring at. So we started at the beginning with this ad.
Right.
And I think that's the point. You should do something that you love rather than that you don't.
Lovely. It's a real privilege to have spent time with you, Vishy. Thank you so much for your time and insights.
Thank you.
I hope you found the conversation as purposeful as I did. For more conversations and nuggets with business leaders, creative professionals, sportsmen, academics, and more, you could visit playtopotential.com. When you're there, you could use a search bar to look for specific sub-themes that you might be curious about. The podcast is also available on iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcast apps if you want to listen offline, let's say during a plane ride or a car ride home. If you find this of value, do take a moment and share a review on iTunes, or share the link with people that you think could benefit from this content. This is your host and curator Deepak Jayaraman signing off now. If you have any feedback on the podcast, I would love to hear from you. Do write in at deepak.jayaraman@transitioninsight.com. I look forward to having you at one of the subsequent conversations of the Play to Potential podcast series. Bye now.